Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Tet Zayin Amud Bet by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, a gozel sadeh mechaveiro, person who steals a field from his friend, assuming that he can steal a field. We know that karka enin igzelet, but the fact is that he's utilizing it, he's taking possession of this property. Vidnatrua misikim. In the meantime, these strong men, government officials, come along and confiscate the property. Imakat midinahi. If it is something that they're doing to everyone in this area, it's not particular to this individual, Omer lo ashelcha lefanecha. He can say to the owner, here's your land, you can take it back. It's not my fault that somebody else walked off with it, because everybody is subject to the same rule, and if you were on the land, if I was on the land, it makes no difference. Imachmata gazlan. If it's because of the gazlan himself that they confiscated the property, meaning that in particular they were looking for this individual's land, or they wanted to penalize him in some way, then chayav lamidos te'acher. Then he has a requirement to replace the field because it's because of him that the field was lost. He was the proximate cause for the fact that they confiscated the field. So Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, man detani mitzikim lo mishtabesh, uman detani mitzikim lo mishtabesh. So obviously there were different girsaot in the Mishnah. Our Mishnah, the way we have the girsa, is mitzikim. But he notes that whether it's mitzikim with a samech or mitzikim with a tzadi, both of those are appropriate words to use here. Interesting enough, the Gemara here is going to quote the psukim to prove this, both of them from the parsha that we read yesterday, Parshat Kitavo. It says, man detani mitzikim, the one who writes mitzikim, lo mishtabesh, is not wrong, dichtiv, because it says in the tochacha, b'matzor u'b'matzok. It actually says it twice there, it's in pasuk nun gimel, pasuk nun hey. And it says there, once about the woman, once about the man, that b'matzor, because of the famine and the siege, u'b'matzok, which is distress or desperate straits. So mitzikim are people who impose or cause mitzuka, and therefore would be an appropriate word over here, because these individuals are difficult individuals. It was also actually, this word was used last night. In the first night of Slichot, we also, the word Matzok was used in the second Slicha that we said. Man detani misikim, and the one who says that we're speaking about misikim with the Samech, lo mishtabesh, also is not incorrect, dichtiv, because it says in the Tochacha, yiyaresh hatzlatzal, umetargaminan, and we translate it, or Unkelus translates it, yachsinine saka'a. So now, the way that Rashi seems to translate it over here, both here and in Chumash, Rashi translates Saka'a to mean Arbet, the locust. And then here, it seems that Rashi, because he does not make any distinction or differentiation, he follows the Targum, which is Yachsinine, which means that they will inherit. The locust will inherit the land, meaning that they're going to overrun the crops. So that's the way that you would explain it here according to Rashi. Rashi in Chumash says that the word here, Yiyaresh, is not from the Shoresh Yerusha, but rather from the Shoresh Rash, from the Shoresh of to make poor or impoverish. And he says that Yiyaresh Atzlatzal is meaning that they will impoverish the area, they will wipe it out, they'll eat everything in sight. So that's Rashi's translation in Chumash, which over here he doesn't make any mention of, it's interesting. Tosafot over here disagrees with Rashi, the Rabbeinu Tam, says that the word Yerusha is improper or not the right word to use with an animal. People inherit areas, animals do not inherit areas. Therefore, he rejects the understanding that Saka'a means locust, but rather he thinks that Saka'a means a band of the enemy, or the troop of the enemy. The Ramban al Torah also translates it the same way, that Saka'a means the enemy, the Oyev. And so that's what it means. Yiyaresh Hatzlatzal is that the enemy will override it, that the enemy will take it over. Then the explanation here of Misikin is the enemy, or the troops or band of troops that are coming along and confiscating the property. So that would be the understanding here. According to Rashi, who says that the Saka'a are the locust, means that locusts are like thieves. They come along and eat up the whole field and they take away what it was yours. The reason that Rashi might not in Chumash translate it as Yerusha is because of the Rabbeinu Tam's criticism here, which is Yerusha doesn't go along with animals, it goes along with human beings. Rashi in Chumash says the word is not Yerusha, it's Rash, to impoverish. The claim of the Ramban in Chumash as to why Rashi is incorrect is that 2 and 3 psukim before there, it talks about the pests coming and eating up all your crops. Then there's an intermittent pasuk there that speaks about the enemy, and then this pasuk, the Ramban says, that it's not contextually making sense to say that the Sakar, the Arbeh, because then it would have been a pasuk before. You should have moved it up. The fact that it's here shows you that it's talking about human beings and the enemy. Although in the end, Tosafot backs off and shows that there are times that in Tanakh, like in Yeshayahu, that the word Yerusha is used by animals and not just by human beings. But anyway, either way, the explanation here is that these Mitzikin or these Mitzikin are individuals who are coming, enemy troops, Gazlanim, that are coming and taking away the property. Imachmada Gazlan Chayav. If it's because of the thief that they confiscate the property, he is responsible. Hechi Domi. What exactly is the scenario here? Ilema de Ansua la Aro, the day that they came along and confiscated all of his property. Velo Ansua Kule Arato. They don't come and confiscate everyone else's property, so it's obvious that it's associated with him, because only confiscating his property, nobody else's property. Hamiresha Shmait Mina. That you could already infer from the Resha. Imakat Midinahi. Ilo Lo. The Resha of the Mishnah already indicates if it's a general problem, then he's not responsible. What you can infer from that is if it was particular to him, then of course he'd be responsible. So then why do you have to write it explicitly? Tosfot already asked, there are many Mishnayot and Shas that have two tzadim to them, and the Gemara never asks, well, you can infer it from the Resha, what do you need the Sefer for? So Tosfot says that if you just wanted to get the inference from the Resha, you could have just said, Bim Lav Chayav. The fact that it explicates and says, Imachmata Gazlan, seems to be that it's indicating something else happened here. There's more to this story than meets the eye. And therefore, you would infer from the Resha that it was a Makat Midina, yes, but if not, then he would be Chayav. So Gemara says, Lo Tzricha, the Achvei Achviuye, that he pointed them to the land. He showed them the land. Now, Tosafot brings two possible interpretations as to what that is. Rashi starts here, She'bibeit ha-melech mivakshim l'gzol sadot. He gets word of the fact that the political powers to be want to confiscate property. And he goes, yeah, look, there's a nice piece over here you might want to look at. And so he indicates or gives them a reference point to come to this location. So he is voluntarily facilitating the ability of the king to come here. So it's only about rumors. They're not particularly after him. They didn't even ask for property, but he kind of facilitates the situation. That's one possible explanation. That's Rashi says Tosafot agrees that that is a possible explanation. Tosafot then brings a second possibility, which is that they came to take his property in particular. But he then showed them which are his properties. Amongst those items or properties that he showed them that are his, he showed them this piece of land. I mean, that wasn't necessary. It's not his land. Karka in an exelet. It really belongs to the original owner still. He could have just not shown them this land, and it wasn't incorrect. It wasn't his land. The fact that he voluntarily showed them this land as well and defined it as part of his ownership, for that reason, he will be responsible over here. Because we're going to see later on in the Gemara that simply pointing out the land, it does not obligate you in terms of Moser or because of Gazlan. But over here, the Gemara seems to indicate that just pointing to the land is enough. So first of all, Tosafot says that this is because of Dina de Garmi, that here we're adjudicating cases of Garmi, where you are not the direct cause, but a proximate cause of the problem. And the sugya will play out a little bit in that way, that we'll see that that's the reason that you're chayav. And the reasons you're chayav here are because you were not compelled in either of these cases to show the property. Either because there was a rumor going around, they were looking for property and you volunteered it, or because they came for your property and then you showed them this piece amongst your property. So in both those cases, you voluntarily gave it over to the authorities, and that's what makes you responsible as the gazlan. Lishna achrina, hachum ma'iskinam k'gon dansu akum, that the akum came along and compelled them. V'amrile achyuye arate, show us your land. V'achyuye ha'u ba'adayu. And he showed them this piece of land with them. That's like the alternate girsa that Tosafot brings down. We have it as a lishna achrina in our Gemara. How gavra dachuye akaria dechite de beresh kaluta. There was an individual who decided that he was going to show the people who were coming to confiscate property, these gazlanim or whoever they were, that he showed them a pile of wheat in the exilarch's property or the exilarch's fields. So after the kamei de Rav Nachman. So they brought the case before Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, who is a dayan, but also married into the family of the Beit Resh Galuta, and he adjudicates the case in Chayevei Rav Nachman Lishlume. He forced the individual to pay for the fact that he showed them the wheat or the property of the Reish Galuta. Yotiv Rav Yosef Achorei de Rav Huna Bar Chia. So Rav Yosef was sitting behind Rav Huna Bar Chia. Yotiv Rav Huna Bar Chia Kamei de Rav Nachman. So in Rav Nachman's court, you have Rav Huna Bar Chia sitting in front of him, and then Rav Yosef behind him. Amalei Rav Huna Bar Chia de Rav Nachman Dina Oknasa. The reason that you pask in this way, is that Mi'ikar Adin? Is that something that's normative halacha? Or is this a penalty that you're imposing on this individual? Amalei Matnitini, it's our Mishnah. Mishnah says it's not. Imachmata gazlan chayav lamid bo sadeh. Acher, our Mishnah says that if it's because of the gazlan, he has to replace the field. Vukimna, and we set up, we qualified the Mishnah and said, what does it mean that he was because of him? That he showed it to him, that he indicated the land. Butter the nafak, after Rav Nachman left, Amalei Rav Yosef, Rav Huna Bar Chia, may nafkalecha amina. Why does it matter whether Rav Nachman said this as a normative din, a normative halacha, or a knas? Idina, iknasa, mamonav shach, the guy has to pay. So if he has to pay either way, why does it matter why he has to pay? So Amalei, idina, gamrina mine. If it is normative halacha, then we can extrapolate from this to other situations, because this is setting a precedent in the law. Iknasa, lo gamrina mine. If it is a fine, then it's a one-time event or something that you cannot necessarily extrapolate from. So whether that means in this particular case or this situation, can you extrapolate the din? Or does that mean, can you more broadly extrapolate the din about dinide garmi? That's the way Rashi explains it. Is this Rav Nachman saying that dinide garmi you are chayav for, and therefore we can extrapolate it to other areas of halacha? Or is it a knas? It's particular to this situation. You can't extrapolate it to the broader din. Again, you can read it like I did at first, which is a narrower explanation, which is simply, is it particular to this individual case? Or can we use this as a more generic or general psak with regards to this issue that everybody who's in this situation should be penalized in such a manner? So he says, how can I prove to you, or can I show you the fact that when you have a knas, you can't extrapolate the din? A knas is a chiddush, and that chiddush cannot be extended to any other halacha. The Tanya, Bishonah, you umrim, in the first place they said, amitameh v'aminaseich. This is something that we saw earlier with the sugya of garmi, but over there it says, someone who defiles his friends, Rashi over here says it's his truma. You could argue even if it was chulin, v'aminaseich, and someone who pours wine libations of his friend's wine. It's machloki between Rav and Shmuel exactly what he did, whether he actually poured the wine libation and generated the problem himself, he was worshipping Avodah Zarah, or is that he mixed it together, Shmuel says, with wine of Yayin Nesech. But in either case, here he's causing a loss to the party, but it's not a loss that is visible and not a loss that is obvious. The fact that this item is Tameh, you can't tell that. It's completely indiscernible in the item itself, and the same is true with the Yayin Nesech. But in both cases, he's caused a monetary loss. The Yayin Nesech is valueless. It's Isra Na'a now, and so therefore it's worth nothing. Then Mitameh, if it's Truma, then he's Kimat made it worthless. A Kohen can use it to burn or use for a candle. If it's Chulin, then he's just diminished the value because there are people who eat Chulin Bitara, or if you want to be Mafish Truma from it, mean that he's causing a diminishment in the value. There, the Chazal said that they are Chayav. It's a Knas that was imposed that you're Chayav in these cases, despite the fact that Me'ikar Adin, the letter of the law, you would not be chayav in these situations. Either it's Hezek She'enu Nikar, it's possibly only Garmi. Chazru Lomar, Af HaMidameya. They went and included, in addition to that, someone who mixes the person's chulin with truma. So this person has chulin, which is something that can be sold openly on the market, and then he mixes in truma, which now can only be sold to a kohen. So again, he's diminished the value because the demand or the possible buyers of this are limited. So again, it caused some damage. Chazru in, lo chazru lo. The fact that they added in the midameya had to require a specific takanat chazal, and you couldn't just have extrapolated it. My time out. What's the reason that they had to institute it with regards to midameya, and we could not extrapolate from midameya minaseich? Is la mishum de knoso. De knoso lo gamrina mine. It's because the other two situations, why you are chayav, is a fine or a penalty, and we can't extend or extrapolate that penalty to another situation without a specific takana that addressed midameya. So that's my proof. When I say this, look, mi kara sabre. No, this is what they thought originally. The hefsid merubah chashashu, the hefsid muat lo chashashu. When there was a large loss or a large monetary loss, in those situations, then we said that there is a takana. Hefsid muat, when you're talking about middameya, which is a smaller loss, lo chashashu. They didn't worry about that. Ubulusov sabre, the hefsid muat, nami chashashu. In the end, they said, you know what? We think that this din should apply not only by greater financial losses, but even by smaller financial losses. Because in terms of mitamei and minasech, if you say that it's mitamei truma, that's probably what drove Rashi to say it here, and minasech, then both of them are almost completely worthless. So there's a serious financial loss caused here. By the case of mitameya, there is value left here because you can sell it to a kohen. It's diminished value, but it's not a complete loss. And so therefore, up front, they were only gozer by the hefsed meruba. And then later on, they said, you know what? Maybe even by hefsed muat, we should extend this takana to those areas. But that would mean that they could extend it without a specific takana. They simply could extrapolate the din. They just have to have the framework of the din. And that's what they did here. They extended the framework of the din. And that would not be the proof that Rav Huna Rav Chiya was looking for. Mar says, wait a minute. Ini, is that really the viable explanation over here? Vatani, avuad Rabbi Avin, birishona yumim hamitamei v'hamidameya. That the first two instituted items were the mitamei and the midameya. So now you can't argue that it's a switch between hefsed meruba to hefsed muat, because here it's including midameya, mitamei, and leaving out minasech. And then only later, chazru lomar afa minasech. So chazru in, lo chazru lo. So that undermines your explanation before, and it goes back to what Rav Huna Rabbi Chiya says, when you want to extend a knas, it has to be done in a manner that is a new institution and not an extrapolation from the previous din. My taima, la mishum delo gamrina miknosa, because you can't extrapolate from a knas. The Gemara says, look, mi kara savrei kirabi avin. In the beginning, they thought, like Rabbi Avin, ulusov savrei kirabi Yirmiya. And then in the end, they held like Rabbi Yirmiya. So what is this din of Rabbi Avin and Rabbi Yirmiya? Sabri k'Rabbi Avin, dama Rabbi Avin, zarak chetz mitchilat arba, the sof arba, v'kara shirayin v'halichato. And it ends up tearing a silk garment on its way. Patur, he's not responsible to pay for that. Shari akira, tzorech hanahachahi, because akira is necessary prerequisite to hanacha. U'mitchayev b'nafsho, and since he's chayav mita, he's not going to be chayav for the shirayin. Here we're talking about the melacha of hotza'ah on Shabbat. The melacha of hotza'ah is a melacha that involves a process. It's not a singular action by which you are chayav. There are many melachot on Shabbat, which is a singular action that makes you chayav. There are other melachot on Shabbat. We've discussed this many times. Bishul, maybe zriya, other types of melachot where it involves a process. One of those is hotza'ah. It's taking something from either Rishut Yachid to Rishut Rabim or carrying something for Amot in the Rishut Rabim. The process involves an akira, taking something from the location which it is in and uplifting it up, removing it from that location, and a hanacha, which is putting it to rest in the new location, bringing it to the destination. So hotza'ah involves a process of akira and hanacha. And without either one of them, you're not chayav for hotza'ah. What Rabbi Avin notes is that without an akira, there is no hanacha. Therefore, the process is a continuum. The melacha of hotza'ah begins with the akira and ends with the hanacha. There's not a singular moment where you violate hotza'ah when you put it down. That's not the moment that you're chayav. You're chayav because of the process that you engaged in, which is the akira and the hanacha. Therefore, if you shoot an arrow, the arrow leaves one location and then lands in the other location. That akira to hanacha is all part of the melacha of hotza'ah. Therefore, if you do damage along the way, that is kamlei derabamine. The person here is violating Shabbat, which involves a chiyuv mita. Even if he doesn't end up, even if he doesn't do b'mezid, it's shogeg, or even if he doesn't end up with a death penalty, we know from Tana Debei Chizkiya, you still get the exemption of the quote-unquote death penalty. And therefore, if it does damage along the way, he's patur for that damage on Shabbat, because of kamlei derabamine. That's the chiddush of Rabbi Avin. If you apply that chiddush of Rabbi Avin over here, you would say the same thing by nisuch hayayin. Nisuch hayayin requires you to pick up the yayin in order to pour the wine libation. So if you extrapolate the din of Rabbi Avin from Shabbat to yayin nesech, that would mean that the picking up of the wine is part of the process of nisuch hayayin. When you pick up the wine, you're koneh the wine as a gazlan. That's hagbah. You already lifted it up. But then you only do the Nisach HaYayin at a later time. So what they thought originally is that Rabbi Avin's din is the same. Just like by Shabbat, the picking up is a prerequisite for the Hanacha, so too by Yayin Nesek, a prerequisite for pouring Yayin Nesek is that you have to lift up the Yayin. And so even though the Hagbah takes place prior to the actual Nisuch HaYayin, we still will apply Kamlei D'Rabamine because your picking up of the wine begins the process of Nisuch HaYayin. So it will be a process just like that of the Melach of Shabbat. And that's why originally they were not gozer, or they did not kones somebody who was menasech the yayin, because they were going to lose their life over this, and there's no reason to be mechayev them because of the fact that it's kamle derabamine. That was the original thought process that went on in this scenario. Again, that favors Rav's explanation here, or the Gemara seems to be leaning to Rav's explanation that there's literally nisuch hayayin over here. If you're speaking about mixing yayin esech, this, none of this would be relevant. Then, it was so, Savik Rabbi Yirmiyah. In the end, they held like Rabbi Yirmiyah. Dam Rabbi Yirmiyah, Mishatak Ba'a Kanya. Then the moment that he lifts it up, he's Koneit, Ichayev Le'mamon. That's when he's Chayev for the Gzela. Mitchayev Be'nafsho, Lo'aviyad Shat Nisuch. But in terms of Nisuch Hayayin, you're not Chayev till later. So here, the Gemara separates the events and makes them discreet and says, the picking up of the Yayin is a Kinyan Akba that creates the Gzela. The pouring of the wine libation makes you Chayev for Yayin Esech. Here we do not see it as a continuum. We don't see it as a process. The reason likely being is that by Shabbat, you put in motion something that by itself or by default will accomplish the melacha. The shooting of the arrow involves an akira by nature that will have an anacha in the end. You do not need to do anything for there now to be anacha. That's considered to be a continuum or a process of melacha. As opposed to over here, where the person picks up the Yayin Esek, he could stop at any point and not do the Yayin Esek and not pour the wine libation. The fact that he picked it up is not automatically or by default that he's going to perform the Aveira of Yayin Esek. You can separate the two items. And since you can make them into discrete items, it's not a foregone conclusion that when you pick it up, you're also engaged in Yayin Esek. And so for that reason, Rabbi Yirmiyah says that you are not subject to kamlei d'rabamine, and therefore you should be chayav, and that's what their conclusion was. In the beginning, they didn't need to put a knas here because they felt that it was under kamlei d'rabamine. After they said that it's not part of kamlei d'rabamine, then they imposed a knas here that the individual should be subject to the monetary penalty. Right? Those were notes over here that the original takana as to why they picked certain items in the original takana, he says that ikal ha-meimer demase ira mitameu minaseich. That the reason that they picked those two originally, or why they picked any two of them originally, seems to be the way that most Takanot Gzeirot came into effect, was that there was a case like that. They got involved, or they saw that there were cases, or a case like this, and therefore they were mitakein. Then they saw later on that they wanted to add in other items to these items that they were originally mitakein. So then they added in, whether it was mitameya, or whether it was minasek, they added in at a later time. But the original takanoa was precipitated by an incident that took place, which is, if you look in the Gemara and Shabbat and many other places, many of the gzeirot of the takanot are broad gzeirot of takanot, but they usually derive from or are started by a particular incident that causes them to react to that particular incident. All right, so now the Gemara says, Rifuna bar Yehuda, ikla lebei evyone, they went to the location of Bay of Yone, at the Kamei Durova. Amalei klum aseh by Bledi Adcha. Did you have any case law or any incidents that came before you? So Amalei Ravuna says to back to Rova, Israel shansua uvdei kochavim, vehera mamon chaviro baliyadi v'chayavtiv. He says, I had an incident where these non-Jewish marauders, again, strongmen, mitzikim, came along and demanded property. And he showed them his friend's land. He didn't bother to show them his own land. He showed them his friend's land and said, here you go, here's a nice piece you might want to take. V'chayavtiv. And I made him responsible for the fact that he gave over his friend's property to seemingly save his life. Amarle Rova says back to him, Adar uvda lemare. You have to reverse your psak. You have to now give the money back. D'tanya, Israel shansua uvde kochavim. Israel who's compelled by non-Jews, Vera Mamon Chaveiro, and he shows them his friend's property, Patur. He is not responsible in that case. Ve'im natal v'natan b'yad, if he actively engaged in it, Chayav, then he is responsible for it. Now, in terms of life-threatening issues, it's clear here that if the person is under duress, under life duress, that if he shows them his friend's property, even though one is not allowed to be matzil atzmo b'mamon chavero, one is not allowed to save themselves with his friend's property, in a case where it's life-threatening, the onus, he was compelled to do this under duress, and since it was under duress, the law says, onus rachmana patre, that we don't make people responsible when they're under duress, when there's an onus, and therefore everybody agrees, if there's a life-threatening issue, that it's not a question that he's not chayav in this case, and he is patur. The question really arises with Yisrael she'ansuhu, is a case of where there is either monetary pressure, or is it life-threatening? It's not clear here from the Gemara as to what the ansuhu is. So again, if it's life-threatening, everybody agrees that you are patur. The question now comes up with if it is a monetary duress. They're looking for his money, and then he shows them his friend's property. Again, when he just shows them the property, it's clear that he is patur because he didn't do anything. He simply showed them the property. He didn't actively engage in the gzela, and therefore he is not chayav in this case. On the other hand, im natal v'natan biyad, if he gets engaged with it physically, here is where you start to see a machloket amongst the poskim, which is that the rishonim there seem to differentiate between a case where, again, it's life-threatening, where nobody thinks, even if he physically engages and gives them the property, that he's an anus, and therefore he's patur, everybody agrees to that. But in a case where they're after his money, and then he actively gives them his friend's property, that's where the Rishonim argue. Some Rishonim say it's still under duress. Since it's under duress, he is patur, even though he physically engaged and gave them the property. When is Nasav Natan Beyad Chayav? Is when he voluntarily gives up the property, where he offers them something and he hands it to them. That's when he would be responsible. But in a case of duress, he would not be responsible. Others suggest that duress, if it's monetary duress and he gets engaged physically with it, there he might be responsible for that because of the fact that he actually physically engaged and gave up someone else's money instead of his own property. Again, here it's not a threat of life, it's a threat of monetary loss or property loss. So in that case, he might be chayav, even if he's under duress, because of the fact that it wasn't necessary for him to give the other property to save his life. It was to save his own money or to save some financial loss over there. He might not be covered by onus rachmana patre, because of the fact that he physically engaged, he actually actively gave them something that's there. That's a difference that comes up amongst the poskim. The Rambam and the Rif believe that when it comes to ones, that is an exemption for turning over the property as long as all you've done is shown them the property. On the other hand, if you actually physically nasab natan bayad, they hold that that ones there is no longer an exemption for you. And in that case, you will be chayav or responsible for the property that you turned over. Ansuu is only a protection when he shows them the property, not when he physically hands them the property. Other Rishonim believe that as long as it's an ones, you're completely patur, that he's exempt no matter what if it's ansuu. And the last way which I explained it to you is the Raivad brings a compromise position which says that when it's under life threat, then he's patur in all cases. When it's under monetary threat, then he's patur. If he shows them the property, he's chayav if he physically engages in the property. If he shows it voluntarily, that's the equivalent of physically handing it over. That is what Tosafot quoted back in our Mishnah, in the Lishna Achrina that we saw in the Gemara, which is where he volunteers to the authorities the property. In that case, it's the equivalent of Nasav Natan Biyad, and he is responsible for it. How Gavra, Dansua Ovde Kochavim, non-Jews came along and pressured him to give up some property or give up some money. And he showed them, now here in the Gemara, it's sometimes very hard to tell that whether the word chamra means wine or chamra means a donkey. Let's assume here it means wine. So he showed them the wine or the barrels of Rav Mari, Breid Rav Pinchas, Breid Rav Chista. Amalei, Dori, Vamate, Bahadan. They said to him, you know what? Thank you for showing us this. We also want you to take it and carry it for us to our destination. So not only did he end up showing them the property, he actually ended up carrying it physically and bringing it to their destination. Dorav Amati Be'adayu, he complied and he took the property and brought it to them. After the coming to Rav Ashi, he came before Rav Ashi, Patrine, he exempted him from compensation. So this seems to go against what we said before, that Nosem Natein Be'yad, if you get physically involved, you are Chayav. So that's the challenge. Amalei Rabon and the Rav Ashi, Va'atanya, Minasem Natein Be'yad, Chayav, that you are responsible. Amalei, Hani, Milei Heiched Delo Ukme Ilavei Mi'ikara. That's only if he didn't originally place them on the property. Va'eched Ukme Ilavei Mi'ikara, Miklei Kalia. That once they were there already, it's as if it's burnt and gone. Basically, we said before that if he just shows them the property, he's not responsible. So over here, he first showed them the property, and then only afterwards did they insist or demand that he engage physically with the property. Once he's shown them the property, and the non-Jews have decided that they're going to confiscate it or take that property, it's done. Whatever is done is done. Now they're asking him to carry the property, they're basically asking him to carry their property. They've already confiscated, they've already taken it. So his engagement in the property is too late in the process to obligate him, because the real facilitating of them taking the property is when he showed them the property. Already then it was done. And once it's done, now when they ask you to come and take it, they're asking you to take their property. They're not asking you to steal it. They're not asking you to actually engage in confiscating the property. It's as if confiscated already. And therefore Rav Ashi says he was patur in that case. Eitvei Rabbi Yebo the Rav Ashi, Amar lo anas, Hoshitli Pkia Amir Ze. He says, please, hand me over these sheaves or this bundle of whatever it is. Oeshkola Navim Ze, or some cluster of grapes. Hoshitlo, and he passes it to him. Chayav, he is responsible. So here it is, no seve, no tem biyad, and therefore he should be responsible. And that would go against Rav Ashi's psak over here, because here the non-Jew already identified the item that he wants. He says, give me that bundle, give me that sheaf, give me that cluster of grapes. So he's identified what he's going to confiscate already. So then when he engages in it, what Rav Ashi said is it's too late. That doesn't matter that he's engaged. He's after the confiscation already. So why over here do we say you're chayav? So achamayeskinan, dekon, dekoy, vitri, abre, denaro. He's on the two sides or two banks of the river. Dekanami, that makes a lot of sense. Dekani hoshit. It says that he passed it to him, lotanantain. It doesn't say hand it to me, it says pass it to me. Which is an indication that it was crossing over some sort of barrier between them and he was handing it over that barrier. This is an answer that's given in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah for the issue of lifnei iver, lotitain michshol, that a person may not facilitate someone else doing an avera. There the Gemara says one of the qualifications for being violate lifnei iver, lotitain michshol, is if you are the facilitator of the avera, which the person could not have done on their own. So the example the Gemara gives over there is Trei Evrei Denaro, two banks of the river. It's a nazir on one side of the river and the wine's on the other side, and you hand him the cup of wine. He would not have had access to the wine without you. That is Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Michshol. But if you're in Charavra Denaro, if you're both on the same side of the river, then the nazir could have taken the wine himself. The fact that you pass it to him might be considered misayeyad over Evera, but it's not Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Michshol, because he'd accomplished it on his own. Same thing over here. The reason that this guy is chayav over here is because they're found on two sides of the river. The thief here, or the person who's coming to confiscate the property, was unable to exercise his right of confiscation because it was on the other side of the river. When you pass it to him, you facilitate the confiscation. That's why you are chayav over there. Because even though he already identified it, that's not sufficient grounds for it to be considered confiscated, because he can't reach it. He can't get to it. When you facilitate it, then you are nosev et notein biyad. You are the one who's actually giving over the property, and that's what makes you chayav in this case. Okay, the Gemara now continues. Hau shuta dava menatsu ala beitre. So there was this, the way Rashi describes it over here was a net or a trap. There are others who speak about some sort of utensil, like a large pestle or mortar, but there is some sort of item that they're having a fight over. Hi, Amar Dideu. Vai Amar Dideu. Each one says it belongs to me. Azal Chai Minayu Masra, the Bahagna, the Malka. One of them went ahead and gave it over to the governor official, the local governing official. Amar Abaye, Yuchol Amar, Ana Ki Masri, Didi Masri. The person who handed over to the government could say, I gave my own property. Why should I have to be any responsibility over here? Samalei Rova, v'chol kaminei, does he really have that right? Mean that we want to adjudicate the case. We don't know for sure it's his. He can make that statement, but that doesn't mean he's right that he's handing it over to the government official and saying that it's his. Elo Amar Rova, mishamtinanlei. We put him into Shamta, Adamaitilei, v'koyi bedina, until he brings it back, and then we can adjudicate the case and figure out who is the real owner over here. He doesn't have a right to hand over property that is in contention to the government officials and claim that it's his. It was under contention, and he has to bring it to a Beit Din. He can't unilaterally make a decision and be moseret. So we're going to put him in Shamta until he shows up with the property so that we can adjudicate the case. How gavra, davaboyi, achvuyei, ativne dechabre. They got wind of the fact that this individual was going to show his friends, teven, his friends, straw, his friends, grains, to the government authorities. So he was going to turn over the property, it seems obviously voluntarily, that he was going to hand over the property to the government, and the local Beit Din got word of that. Ata the kamei de Rav. They brought him before Rav. Amarle, lo techave, lo techave. He says, don't show it to them, don't show it to them. He's warning them that he's not allowed to do this. It's improper, it's illegal for him to hand over this property to the government authorities. Amarle, mechavina u mechavina. He responds to Rav and says, I'm going to show it, I'm going to show it, I'm going to hand it over. Meaning that I don't really care what you say, Rav. Yoti Rav Kahana kamei de Rav. Rav Kahana, Talmid of Rav, was sitting there in the Beit Din with Rav. Shamte lekoei. I mean, he broke his neck bone. Basically, he hit him in the back of his neck and he killed him. Rav Kahana killed the guy who was going to be moser his friend's property voluntarily to the government officials. Now, Rav Kahana kills him for two reasons over here. One is because he's a moser. Number two is because he's a chutzpah in the way that he responded to Rav. We have a similar story at the end of the Gemara in Yoma with regards to a butcher who refused to apologize to Rav for being a mechutzaf. And over there, he ends up dying on Erev Yom Kippur because Rav went to extract an apology from him and he refused to apologize to Rav. So you see that there is this issue of death penalty for someone who's mechutzaf to the Beit Din or to the Godol Ador. And it's usually min hashamayim. Here, Rav Kahana is interceding. But Rav Kahana is also interceding not just because of the chutzpah, because he's also a moser. Rav defends Rav Kahana's actions and says, Kori Rav Yilavei, he quotes the pasuk from Yishayahu, this is one of the haftarot that we read as part of the Shiva de Nechemta, Banayich Ulfu, your children have fainted, Shachvo Berosh Kol Chutzot, they are laid out on all the different streets, Kito Michmar, like a wild bull who's captured in its net. The wild bull who's hard to catch, but once they have him in the net, they're not going to have any mercy, not going to release him. They're going to end up shechting him. They're going to use him for food at that point in time. So too, when it comes to Jewish property, once the Ovdei Kochavim get their hands on it, they have no mercy. So what Rav is indicating from here is that it's a downward spiral. Rishonim suggests that not only would it end up just being monetary confiscation, but even possibly losing of his life. I mean that once they get their claws into a specific individual, first of all, they're not just going to take the small property that they were shown, they're going to drain him of all of his assets, and then maybe even go after him himself, or the draining of all of his assets is going to cause him to be in such a predicament that he's going to lose his life. So Rav sees a downhill or downward spiral that is generated by a moser, and therefore the moser is subject to a death penalty. What's interesting about this is that Jewish authorities and Batei Dinim, even though they did not enforce death penalties, even when they had judicial autonomy, and this happens many times throughout Jewish history where the Jews, especially in Babel and in Persia, where they had judicial autonomy, they never exercised or generally did not exercise the death penalty with one exception, and that is that of a moser. And that was something there they did execute these individuals, and that was way through the Middle Ages. We still see incidents or events like that where a moser is killed because of this problem, that once you open up Pandora's box, the issue does not just stop at a one-time event. These types of people who are moser cause tremendous difficulties for the Jewish community and the survival of the Jewish community. And therefore they were not viewed very favorably, or even to the point of quote-unquote death penalties, which is brought down again by the poskim. Not just as that's the Mesorah that's that way, but there is a clear path, a normative path, to say that these people are deserving of death because of what happened over here. The truth is that this has been, I would say, misappropriated or misused in some cases, which is when somebody does something illegal, something that's clearly against the law, then some people invoke this principle of moser. For instance, in cases of pedophilia or cases where people act improperly, and the only way to stop them is to get the authorities involved because they're being protected by the communities that they live in. So there, some people claim if you turn them over to police, that's a problem of moser. Now, many poskim and make it very clear that that is not the case, because moser is only when they are coming with a claim that is either trumped up or a claim where they don't adjudicate according to law or according to a body of law that is fair and equitable. But if you're talking about a society in which there are civil laws, a person has done a criminal act which is dangerous to the victims, and the fact that he's still around is dangerous to other individuals, then in that case, being moser such an individual to stop them from engaging in that activity is not considered to be misira, and it's okay to inform the authorities if that's the only way to stop such an individual from engaging in this improper behavior or illegal activity, which is to the detriment of the community. And so, again, it's been a fight in the last decade or so around these issues of criminal acts, sexual acts, where individuals are acting clearly improperly, clearly to the detriment of society at large and to their victims. And if they're let to stay in place, they're going to cause more damage. But the community hasn't given them up, then the victims or people who are in the know have turned them over to the authorities. And there's been a backlash against those individuals that they are mosrim. But it's not the case. Mosrim only involved, again, when it involves something that is trumped up charges or places where they do not adjudicate according to the letter of a law or a proper equitable law. So then, Amalei Rav Kahana, Ada Idna Avu Parsai Delo Kapta Yashvichu Damim. Until now, the local authorities were these Persians who don't worry about Shvichu Damim. They don't worry about killing. But now we have the Greeks here, the Kaptu Shvichu Damim, who are careful about Shvichut Damim. You can see there's an alternate girsa here that flips Yivanai and Parsai around over here. And Tosfot discusses that issue. Vamre Maradin Maradin. They're going to call me a killer, a killer. What seems to be the case here, because in terms of the Greeks and even the Romans that Tosfot mentions, they did not necessarily make it to the areas where Rav lived in Bavel or in Persia. They made it pretty far east, but it was along those borderlines, and we know that from stories of certain Jewish communities that were back and forth between the Romans and the Persians, but it didn't seem to reach as far east as where Rav was. So it's unlikely that they were speaking about the actual Greeks or the Romans, but they're more likely speaking about is a transition in the Persian authority, which is that the Sassanid dynasty took over at a certain point, likely in the lifetime of Rav or in the later life of Rav, where they changed the dynamic of the Persian rule. The Persian rules before that afforded huge autonomy to the local communities, both religious and judicial autonomy, and they let everybody run their own show, as long as they paid their taxes to the central government. When the Sassanids took over, they started to consolidate the central authority and impose central authority both from a judicial standpoint and even sometimes religiously they try to impose on individuals. And that's likely what's being referenced over here by Rav Kahana, is this change in the new Persian rulers who have a different view about rule. They don't think that rule is everybody's autonomous and we just have this central authority. They wanted a very strong central authority, and therefore they start to impose their rules. That means that in terms of killing the individual, in the old days, that was something that would be left up to the local community to deal with. And since Rav has the Beit Din, they can make a decision that Rav Kahana acted appropriately, he's not deserving a death penalty. On the other hand, once you involve central authorities here, then he's going to be brought to trial based on the government Bati Dinim, and they're going to bring him on trial for murder. So now he has to run away because the authorities are going to come after him. Kum sak la'arad Yisrael. Rav says, go run away to Eretz Yisrael. V'kabel alecha delo tikshe l'Rabbi Yochanan sheva shnin. And accept upon yourself that you won't question Rabbi Yochanan for 7 years. Now, we're going to see from later on in the story why Rav was going to be makpid on this. It's interesting that Rav had any inkling about Rabbi Yochanan because Rav was in Rabbi Shir, and he was the top student in Rabbi Shir. At that time, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were young whippersnappers in the back row of Rabbi Shir. And you can see that, we'll see later on in the Gemara's that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, in discussing about Rav, say, don't you remember Rav, that guy who was in the front row, who used to be like the big shot in the Shir? So it's clear that Rav is significantly older and more advanced than Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. And then Rav leaves for Bavel because of the problem with Rabbi Chanina or Bnei Rabbi Chanina, that they basically chase him out of town so that he doesn't take over as the Nasi. So he goes to Bavel. The fact that now he's aware of Rabbi Yochanan or about Rabbi Yochanan's tremendous erudition as well as power inside of the teachings of Eretz Yisrael is interesting because, again, Rabbi Yochanan is much younger than Rav. But here Rav says, don't bother Rabbi Yochanan for 7 years. In 1 second we'll see maybe why he said it. The Marsha claims over here that it was a midah connected midah, because over here Rav Kahana paskined in front of Rav, his Rebbe. Meaning that he took the matters into his own hand and he killed this guy without asking Rav. So he paskined to kill the Moser without Rav's acquiescence to the situation. So therefore, as a part of his midah connected midah, he has to go sit in front of Rabbi Yochanan and not ask him questions for 7 years, in order to learn what it means to have a Rebbe and not paskin in front of your Rebbe. That's what the Marsha claims. You'll see from the story maybe that there was a different reason Rav made that suggestion. Azal Ashkechei the Reish Lakish, the Yalti become Isayim Mitifta de Yoma the Rabbonan. He came there and he saw that Reish Lakish was reviewing over the shir that Rabbi Yochanan gave to the Rabbonan. Reish Lakish is a Talmud Chaver of Rabbi Yochanan. He's the top guy in Rabbi Yochanan's shir. And so after Rabbi Yochanan gives the, you know, shir klali, then Reish Lakish reviews it with the Talmidim. So he's reviewing with them. It seems like it means diyoma over here means the day, that day's learning. You could argue mitifta diyoma means that it was the masechet yoma that he was reviewing with them. Amar lahu, so Rav Kahana says to them, Reish Lakish heicha, where is Reish Lakish? So he's obviously aware of Reish Lakish as well. Amar lei amai, said back to him, why do you want to know? Amar lahu, so without responding to them, he says to them, hi kushya, hi kushya. He says on the sugi that they're learning, there's this question, there's this question. Hi piruk of Ibru, and here's the answer, and here's the answer. Amru le the Reish Lakish, the Talmidim go and tell Reish Lakish that there's this guy who showed up, starts asking all these wild questions on the sugya and answering the questions. He's obviously someone who is very well versed in these gemarot. Azo Reish Lakish, Amru le the Rabbi Yochanan. So Reish Lakish goes and informs Rabbi Yochanan, Ari alami Bavel. A lion has been roaring, has come up from Bavel. Make sure that you review an extra time that which you're going to teach tomorrow so that he doesn't catch you, meaning that he doesn't ask questions that he can't answer. The on that first day, they sat him in the first row of the Talmidim in front of Rabbi Yochanan, Kameh Rabbi Yochanan. So obviously the indication is that the better students sat in the front rows, and then the lower, as you went back in the rows, you were lower in students. That means that the students in the front row were expected to be the ones asking the questions, the ones that would be the most versed in that which they were learning and able to challenge the Rebbe. So they put him in the first row, assuming that he was someone of great stature and that he was going to challenge Rabbi Yochanan. Amar Shmaitata v'lo Akshay. Shmaitata v'lo Akshay. Rabbi Yochanan would say something, and Rav Kahana remained silent. He would say something, Rav Kahana remained silent. Anchate achorei sheva dare ado dvei bedara batra. They pushed him back one row by row, 7 rows, until he was seated in the back row. Meaning that he remained silent, like Rav had instructed him. He does not ask any questions of Rabbi Yochanan, and therefore they demote him from the first row of the Beit Midrash to the back row, 7 rows back, in the final row, or the last row that is in front of Rabbi Yochanan. So they demoted him. Amalei Rabbi Yochanan the Reish Lakish, Arish Amart, Naseh Shual. That lion that you spoke about coming up from Bavel, he's turned into a little fox. Meaning that he's not so scary, doesn't really have a bite, doesn't have a roar to him. He seems to be nothing. Amar. So now Rav Kahana says, Hey Ravah, Yehi Ratzon, it should be God's will, Dehani Sheva Dari, These 7 rows should be the equivalent of the 7 years that Rav said. Rav said to him he's not allowed to ask Rabbi Yochanan a question for 7 years. Here he is demoted and moved back 7 rows. So Rav Gana sees in that symbolically, that as if he's waited the 7 years because he's pushed back 7 rows. Kama kare, he jumped up on his feet. Amalai nahader mar bereisha. Start over from the beginning, he says to Rabbi Yochanan. Amar shmaitata, Rabbi Yochanan starts to say something. Va'akshe, and he starts questioning him. Ukme bedarakama, they brought him back to the front row. Amar shmaitata va'akshe. Rabbi Yochanan kept saying things, and he was throwing questions out left and right. So he's starting to stump Rabbi Yochanan in the shir. Rabbi Yochanan ayotiv asheva bistarke. He was sitting on, whether it was 7 pillows, 7 mattresses, 7 comforters. Shavle chada bistarka mitutei. They pulled out one of them from under him. Amar shmaitetav akshile. He said the next thing over, and Rabbi Kahana challenged him and stumped him again. Ad the shavle kulu bistarke mitutei. Until they started removing everything that was under Rabbi Yochanan. I mean, Rabbi Yochanan was given that stature or status because of his tremendous erudition as a Talmud Chacham. As Rabbi Kahana, in a sense, demotes him, because now Rabbi Kahana is coming in and challenging him, and Rabbi Yochanan doesn't have the answers to the questions, they slowly demote Rabbi Yochanan and take away the pillows that are under him, meaning that they're showing that he is less and less of that stature because there's someone here who is of a greater stature than him. Ad diyoti valaro. Till finally Rabbi Yochanan was sitting on the ground just like the Talmidim. Rabbi Yochanan gavra savahavo. Rabbi Yochanan was very elderly. Umisarche gavine. And his eyelashes were very heavy, leaning over his eyes, that he was unable to see or was very difficult for him to see because of his eyelashes or his eyebrows were very thick and they used to cover over his eyes. So he was unable to open his eyes or clearly see. Amalu daluli einai. He says to the people who service him, Shamashim, come and lift up my eyes. Vachse, so I can see this person who is challenging me. Dalule b'mekachalta de kaspa. You can see this type of society that we're talking about, a hierarchical society here, where when they come to lift up Rabbi Yochanan's eyebrows or eyelashes, they take a silver fork and they gently lift up his eyes so that he can see. Chaza de parte sifvate. He saw, Rashi says over here, that his lip was split, or that this is something where, that he had an extended mouth or lip, and therefore, sabor achuch kimechayech bay. So to Rabbi Yochanan, it looks like Rav Kahana is laughing at him. Again, it was the natural state because of his lip either was torn, or that he had some sort of deformity that caused his mouth to be stretched, and it looked like he was smiling all the time. So Rabbi Yochanan took offense to the fact that he thought he was laughing at him or that he was making fun of him, that he was challenging him in these cases. Chalash date, Rabbi Yochanan felt bad about this, meaning that he was affronted by this. V'nach nafshe, and therefore Rav Kahana passed away. And we have similar stories with that with regards to Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan in the end kills Reish Lakish because of a disagreement between them when Rabbi Yochanan got upset at Reish Lakish. And a similar story is brought by the Gemara with regards to Reish Lakish's son. Remember, Reish Lakish married Rabbi Yochanan's sister, and Reish Lakish's son was learning in front of Rabbi Yochanan, and he was a young whippersnapper and challenging Rabbi Yochanan. And then Rabbi Yochanan, in a similar scenario, says, I can't see him, dalene, lift up my eyes, go and see him. His sister runs in and grabs her son out of there and says, no way, you're not going to do to my son what you did to my husband, and kill him. So again, a similar type of incident where Rabbi Yochanan is obviously very powerful, and if you upset Rabbi Yochanan, that's not going to be a good end for you. So l'machar amarlu Rabbi Yochanan l'rabbonon chazitu l'bavlo heichi ovid. So Rabbi Yochanan says to Rabbonon the next day, justifying what basically happened to Rabbi Yochanan, that he passed away, or that he had killed him, by looking at him, and says, do you see that he was laughing at me? Amrulei darkei hachi. They said that he wasn't laughing. That's the way he looks. That's his natural look because he has this split lip. Al gabe ma'arto. So Rabbi Yochanan goes to visit the burial cave of Rav Kahana. Chaza dahava hadra le achna. He saw that there was a snake wrapped around the entrance to the cave. Meaning that there was a snake, as Rashi says, that was coiled in front of it and had its tail inside of its mouth to block access to there. to anybody who wanted to go in there. Usually this is associated with a Talmid Chacham. We have a similar story, I think, by Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. We're going to see that in the Gemara in Baba Metzia. Also that there was a snake around protecting him, or protecting his grave. So here, the snake is blocking Rabbi Yochanan's access to Rav Kahana. There is obviously some sort of symbolic imagery here of the Nachash HaKadmon, the original snake, but the fact that a snake is protecting and forcing Rabbi Yochanan not to be able to enter. So Rabbi Yochanan says to the snake, open up your mouth, meaning release your tail from your mouth, open up, let me go in, so that the Rav, me, Rabbi Yochanan the Rav, can enter in to see the Talmid, Rav Kahana. Velo patach, didn't budge. Yikaneis chaver etzel chaver, he says, let the peer enter the other peer. Velo patach, the snake doesn't budge. Yikaneis Talmid etzel Rav, let the student enter into the Rebbe. Patachle, then the snake opens it up. Once Rabbi Yochanan finally realizes what his status is vis-a-vis Rav Kahana, meaning that Rav Kahana is significantly greater than Rabbi Yochanan, once Rabbi Yochanan has realized that or acknowledged that, then the snake opens up and allows Rabbi Yochanan to go in. He davens to Hashem and asks for Rachamim to bring him back to life. And he does. He comes back to life. Amarle, so then Rabbi Yochanan says to Rav Kahana, Iyavi yadana de darkei de mar hochi, had I known that this was your natural look, lo chal shadati, I wouldn't have been so distressed or distraught over the fact that you looked like you were laughing at me, and then I wouldn't have killed you. Hashta leite mar bahadan. Come back with me to the Beit Midrash. Come and learn with me in the Beit Midrash. So Amarle, Rav Kahana responds to him, im matzit mi bayirach meititu lo shchivna. If you are willing to daven and make sure that I'm not going to die again, azilna, I'm going to come with you. Ilo, lo azilna. But if not, I won't go with you. Meaning that Rav Kahana says, not every day is there a miracle that is done. Similar to the story in Megillah, where Rabba shachted the Rabbi Zeira, and then Rabbi Zeira, the following year, Rabba invites him to come to the Purim Suda, and he says, not every time is there going to be a miracle. I can't rely on the fact that you're going to bring me back to life because of the incident that happened last year. So similarly here, Rav Kahana says, how can I trust that I can come back to Beit Midrash? You're not going to kill me again, or I'm not going to die again. Whether he is saying that about Rabbi Yochanan and the situation, or just saying, now that I've died already once, I don't want to face death again, daven that I'll have a long life, that I'll have a richud yamim. Something along those lines that he's making a request of him. It's not clear what happens here in the Gemara. It says, hoil v'chalif shata chalif. Once the moment had passed, it passed. Tyre, he was awakened already. Ukme, he had him sit up. And Shaila called Sveika Davile, Upashtina Niale. Yochanan asks any questions that he had, any Sveikot, he asked of Rav Kahana. And Rav Kahana answers him about all of these issues. So, what's clear here is that Rav Yochanan converses with Rav Kahana, and he learns from Rav Kahana. What's not clear from the story is what exactly happened. What is meant by Chalif Shato? Since the moment passed, it passed. The way that Rashi seems to explain it is that once he was already awakened and the miracle happened, so he's already up. So Rabbi Yochanan just forced him to go. Meaning that he didn't respond to Rav Kahana's request. He just simply said, look, I already had the miracle happen. You're alive. So I may as well learn from him and have him go on. Like he picked him up and he brought him back to life and let him go. Others say that the idea of Chalif Shata means that since the moment has passed, and we got him to be alive, I may as well ask him some questions, but not that he went back to live on another life. After he finished asking him, he went back to sleep, or he went back and passed away. Rashi over here brings a proof to his understanding that Rav Kahana actually did live, because he says later on, we find stories about Rav Kahana returning to Bavel. And he says that I was put into Galut, I ended up in exile because I married a Bat Kohen, and therefore I was put into Galut. And he's obviously describing this incident of going to Eretz Yisrael. That means that Rav Kahana later on is found in Bavel, back in his own house, and he's discussing about the fact that he was in Galut. So it shows from there that he did, actually not only was he awoken and spoken to, but he actually left there and went back to his house. But then according to Rashi, he didn't stay in the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yochanan. He went back home because he didn't want to risk staying in the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yochanan. Others suggest that he went back to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yochanan. But then Rabbi Yochanan has a statement here which Rashi interprets in the following way, which is, Hainu d'amar Rabbi Yochanan, d'chon amre d'lhonhi. That Rabbi Yochanan says, that which we thought belonged to the Bnei Yisrael, really belongs to Bnei Bavel. And so what Rashi says is, Rabbi Yochanan, who's a Ben Eretz Yisrael, says, I thought the Torah was the purview of Bnei Eretz Yisrael. After I had this incident with Rav Kahana, I realized that the Torah really belongs to Bnei Bavel, which is that they are much stronger in their Torah learning. And therefore, I give credit to the Bnei Bavel because of this incident with Rav Kahana. That's how Rashi explains it. Rabbi Yochanan would tell his Talmidim that the Torah that you have is from Bavel because Rav Kahana answered all my questions. Rav Kahana helped me get everything straight. That's the way Rashi interprets it. Tosafot, here and many other places in Shas, he notes in the Gemara in Brachot, he says it in the Gemara in Kiddushin as well. Tosafot in many places says that when Rabbi Yochanan is speaking, many times he's speaking to Talmidim from Bavel. Rabbi Yochanan had many students in front of him, students from Eretz Yisrael, as well as students from Bavel. The Gemara in the other locations, like in Kiddushin and Brachot, says Halan Halahu. That's for us, that's for them. For us, meaning Bnei Eretz Yisrael, for them, meaning Bnei Bavel. The problem is that it seems to assign the position of Bnei Bavel to Rabbi Yochanan. And so Rashi, therefore, doesn't believe that that's the right explanation. And he says, Halan Halahu, explains that that's what's good for the Bnei Eretz Yisrael. And he aligns that with the position of Rabbi Yochanan, and that's what's good for Bnei Bavel. Tosfot in both those instances says it's wrong, it's the other way around. Rabbi Yochanan's in Eretz Yisrael. Why is he talking about what they did in Bavel? Because there were many Babylonian students in front of Rabbi Yochanan. And Tosfot over here says the same thing. So when Rabbi Yochanan here is speaking, he's speaking to his Talmidim from Bavel, and saying to his Talmidim from Bavel, Dilchon Amre Dilchoni, your guy, Rav Kahana, says that this is our making. So he's saying to the Talmidim from Bavel, your guy, Rav Kahana, who is from Bavel, said the following. And he's the Rabbeinu Hananel and the Rabbeinu Tam both say it's referring to a specific event that is actually found in the Gemara in Sukkah as well as in the Gemara in Gittin with regards to the practice of taking the Aravot on the seventh day of Sukkot or on Hashanah Rabbah. That taking of the Arava or Chavata Tarava is a machloket as to whether it is a Yisod Nevi'im, meaning it was instituted by the Nevi'im, or Minhag Nevi'im, which means it was instituted by the Chachamim. Rav Kahana is of the belief that it was instituted by the Chachamim. And that's what Rav Yochanan is saying to the Talmidim from Bavel, he's saying, Dolchon, your guy, Rav Kahana says, Dolhoni, says that it is a Minhag Nevi'im, that it is just an institution, the Rabbanan. And that's how he's explaining the halacha. But how did Rabbi Yochanan know that, or what was Rabbi Yochanan's connection to Rabbi Kahana, is the previous incident, which is that's what Rabbi Yochanan says many times, that he learned this from Rabbi Kahana, and he learned this from Kahana after he brought him back to life. And that's what the reference here is to this statement of Rabbi Yochanan. Now going back to the original part of the story where Rav sends Rabbi Kahana to Rabbi Yochanan, he told him, don't ask questions for 7 years. It's likely that Rav knew that Rabbi Yochanan was quote-unquote a dangerous individual, that if you upset him, that you were in big trouble. So Rav Kahana, who is a very, very erudite Talmud Chacham, would be able to challenge Rabbi Yochanan to the point that it would upset Rabbi Yochanan. And so Rav might have known that that would have been a problem, and therefore he advises Rav Kahana not to bother Rabbi Yochanan for the first 7 years until he finally gets acclimated and Rabbi Yochanan's familiar with him. Then maybe he can start asking questions in order not to endanger his life. It's interesting that Rabbi Yochanan has this power because it's also a power of Shim Bar Yochai. And we find many places in Shas where Rabbi Yochanan quotes in the name of Shim Bar Yochai, that we have a Masorah that says, Am Rabbi Yochanan, Am Rabbi Shim Bar Yochai, and that they had a similar type of personality where if you upset them, that usually ended up with you being dead. And there are many stories in the Gemara of the same thing, Rabbi Shim Bar Yochai, with Talmidei Chachamim, and the problem that if they upset him or they asked him difficult questions where he thought they were upstarts or making fun of him, that they also were killed, similar to what happens here with Rabbi Yochanan. Right. Someone indicated or showed property of Rabbi Ava to the authorities. Now this, Tamkasa Rashi says is Takshit Shel Meshi, some sort of silk garment, something that was expensive or valuable. Yotiv Rabbi Bau, Rabbi Chanina Bar Papi, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka, V'yotiv Rabbi Yelog Gabayu. So here you have a group of Talmidei Chachamim that are sitting around, and Rabbi Yelog is with them. The Rabbeinu Tam points out in other places in Shas, that whenever the Gemara enumerates a large number of Chachamim and says, this Chacham is also sitting with him, you should expect that that Talmud Chacham is going to say the Chiddush or the important line in their conversation, which is Savor the Chiyuve. They thought that this Moser should be responsible for what he did. Mihad Itznan from this Mishnah. Danat Adin, Zikat Achayav, if a judge gave the wrong psak halacha, came to the wrong conclusion in a case, and he was Zikat Achayav, exonerated that one who was responsible or Chayav, V'chayev et zakai, or he obligated the party that was innocent, Timei et Tor, he made that which was Tor, Tamei, V'tier et Tamei, or he made that which is Tamei Tor, Masha Asa Sui, his psak stands, V'shalei B'beito, and he's got to pay out of pocket to rectify the situation, to straighten out the mistake that he made. So over there it sounds like, even through simply speaking, a person can be obligated to make payment to restitution. Over here, the judge, the only thing he did was give a psak halacha orally, verbally, and yet he's being held responsible to pay for it. So too, in our case of the moser, he should be responsible for the verbal giving over of the property of another individual to the authorities. Amar lei Rabbi Yilah, as we expect, the Rabbi Yilah is going to be the one who answers the group and says something. Hachi amar Rav, this is what Rav says, v'ushin asar natan b'yad. We have a qualification of that Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which tells us that that's only true where the judge physically gave the psak halacha. But Shagmar, we've discussed a little bit in Baba Kama, more extensive Sanhedrin goes through each of the cases, but he took the money from one party, handed it to the other party, took a mashkon that was collateral, handed it back to the debtor. He got involved physically in the case. And therefore, being involved physically in the case, that's what made him responsible. It was not his oral psak that got him in trouble. It was the fact that he actively engaged in the case. So Amar Lei Zil Lagabi Rabbi Shimon ben Eliakim, Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat, the Dine Dini de Garme. So they give him advice and say, go over to these Chachamim because they adjudicate cases of Garmi. Azal Lagabayu, he went to them, and Chayavei Mimatznitin. They required him to pay because of our Mishnah. Chayav If it's because of the Gazlan that the property was given over, he has to replace the property. V'Iklimna, and we already established or qualified our Mishnah. It's a case of Dachyuyei Achvuyei. It's a case where he showed them the property. And that's exactly our case over here. This individual showed the authorities Rabbi Abba's property. And again, it has to be a case where he wasn't under duress. He simply voluntarily showed them the property. And since he voluntarily showed them the property, he's held accountable. And this is what Tosfot said at the beginning of the Sugya, that the reason you're Chayav over here is because of Garmi. Because you see here, they told Rabbi Abba to go to those people that paskin that Dinei de Garmi are Chayav, and then they're going to force this guy to pay. So you see, it's because of Dinei de Garmi that when you show the property, you're held accountable for doing such. How Gavra, David Mafkid Le Kasa de Kaspa. There was an individual who had a silver goblet deposited with him to watch. Sliku Ganve Ilave. These thieves came to steal from him. Shaklo Yava Lehu. He took the silver goblet and handed it to them. Atag the Kame de Rabba, Patre. They brought the case before Rabba, and Rabba says he's Patur. The Shomer is Patur in this case. Amle Abaye, Hai Matzila Tzmoba Maun Chaberohu. This is a guy who's saving his life with his friend's possessions. Elam Amar Avashi Chazina. E Inish Amidu. If he's a very wealthy individual, Adaitati Deyatu. They came to confiscate his property. So now, it's not necessarily Matzil Atzmo is saving his life, but Matzil Atzmo is he's saving his own money or his own property. If he's a wealthy individual, the Ganavim didn't have any idea that he was watching some silver goblet for someone else or was deposited with him. They came because he's a wealthy guy and they wanted to rob him. So now if they come and rob him and then he hands the silver goblet to them, then he's saving his own property with someone else's property. Over there, he will be responsible. He will be Chayav. Vilo, if he's not a wealthy individual, Adaita de Kaspa Atu. Then the Ganavim came to steal the silver goblet. That's the only thing this guy had. He didn't have worth anything. He didn't have a lot of money. The only thing that he had that was valuable was that somebody deposited this silver goblet. Therefore, if the Ganavim came for that and he hands it to them, he is not Chayav. Now, Tosafot clarifies that and says, why is that? If you physically hand over the item, then you are Chayav. So why isn't he Chayav? He physically handed it to them. Omeri, the shiny Shomer. A Shomer is different than a normal person. Because that is a part of the condition of the deposit. That one of the dispensations he gets, or one of the conditions of his work is, that if somebody comes to steal this specific item, he can hand them the item. He doesn't have to give up his own property. He doesn't have to give up his own life. He can hand over the property to other parties. So the Ri says it's an embedded condition in being a shomer, and therefore, even though over here he physically handed it over to them, he won't be held responsible for that because he's given that right as a shomer to hand over the property when they come specifically for that piece of property. There was this individual who had a purse, a wallet full of money that was deposited with him. The money was designated for pinyon shivuim, to redeem captives. Not necessarily any particular captives, but captives in general. Sliku ganve ilave. These ganavim came and attacked him to get the money that he had. Shaklo yava nialayu. He took the money pouch and handed it to the ganavim. Atu the kamei, probably the rabba, should be probably rabba again. Patre, again, he exempted him from payment. He said, you don't have to pay for it. Amalei Abayi, so Abayi again challenged him and says, Amatzil atzmo b'manchov erohu. He again saved himself using his friend's money. He saved himself from whatever the ganavim would have done had he not handed it over. So the question about what his status is over here, Tosfot says that from the fact that the Gemara over here doesn't make the distinction that it made in the previous case, is he rich? Is he not rich? Here, the Gemara doesn't make that distinction. You have to assume that he was wealthy. And that the ganavim were coming even to take his property because he was a wealthy individual. So Rabbi says back to Abaye, there's no greater redemption of a captive than this situation. Here they were putting him under duress. And the fact that they were putting him under duress, demanding ransom from him, basically the equivalent of taking him captive and demanding a ransom payment, oh, they're demanding that he pay money to them or give up his property to them, otherwise they're going to do whatever they're going to do to him. So when he hands him over the money of Pidyon Shvuyim, that's exactly what he's doing. He's redeeming someone who's being held for ransom. It happens to be he himself here. And therefore, that's why he was justified in handing over the money. Ha'u Gavra, da'aktim va'asik chamra l'mivra, kamei desliku inche b'mavra. So now, the first thing is there's a question about the gear, so you can see that already in the Masorah of the Shas, that whether the word aktim was there. The way we have it in our gear, so the word aktim means that he got on first. And the way that Rashi describes it is, this individual was taking a raft across the river. A mavra is some sort of ferry or raft that takes you across the river from one side to the other side. So this individual, the way we have it in our gear, so got on the raft first with his donkey. And then other people joined them on the raft. But then, boy, let's buye. So then the raft started to sink, either because the animal was too heavy, or because the animal was becoming wild on the raft, and therefore they were fearful of the fact that it was going to sink or capsize the raft or the ferry. Atu gavra, malach le the chamra. So then this individual came along and basically tossed the chamor into the river. He threw him off the raft. What the word malach means over here is unclear. Whether it means malach, like a captain of a ship, like milachim that are mentioned in Sefer Yonah, or malach means here to direct, I mean the equivalent of a captain of a ship, that's someone who directs something, but here he directed the chamor into the river. Whatever, he commandeered the animal, he commandeered the ship and threw the animal off. Atu gavra, malach le the chamor da'u gavra. The donkey of that individual, v'shadi l'naro, and threw it in the river, v'tava, and it drowned. Atu the kamei de rabba, they came before rabba to adjudicate whether he has to repay him for throwing the donkey into the river. Patre, he said he is patur. Amalei Abayi, v'amatsu letzmo b'machon chaverohu. Again here, they're trying to save himself by throwing his friend's property overboard. Amalei, haimeikora, rodef hava. That donkey originally was a rodef because the ship was going to sink because of the donkey. And therefore the donkey is as if he's chasing these individuals to kill them. And so they defensively can act to stop that and throw him into the river to protect themselves to ward off this rodef. And that's one way to explain the Gemara. Again, I noted before that the Girs of Aktim is not clear over here. Possible that he didn't get on first, but rather he got on last. That would make him more likely to be considered a rodef in that case if he got on last rather than first, because then he was the added weight that caused the raft or ferry to seem like it's going to sink. The other possibility also here is chamra is not a donkey, but chamra is wine. That he brought barrels of wine onto the raft of the ferry, and they weren't made to carry large loads across. They were made to ferry people across. Meantime, he has this load on there, and it's causing the raft of the ferry to capsize. So they throw the wine into the river in order to lighten the load of the raft of the ferry. So that's the other possibility as to what the exact story was over here. Now, Rabba the Tamei, Rabba is the Shitato. Dama Rabba, Rodef, Shei Rodef, Achar Chavirolo, or Go. Person is chasing another individual in order to kill them. Unjustifiably, because generally killing another person is not legal. So he's chasing them down. Vishiber Dakilim. And along the way, he does damage to people's property. Ben Shil Nirdaf, Ben Shil Kol Adam. Whether it's the guy he's chasing, whether it's anybody else, third party's property, Patur. He does not have to make restitution in that case, or mitchayev b'nafsho. Because the whole time that he's chasing this individual, he's subject to the death penalty. We already discussed this from Abba Machteret. Someone who's a rodef basically opens himself up to being killed, because if you have to stop him by killing him, you're granted the right to kill him. Both a nirdaf, as a defensive act, can kill him, or someone else can intercede on behalf of the nirdaf and kill the rodef. So since he is now open season to kill him, he's like chayav mitah. Since he's chayav mitah, he's commonly the rabbi minei, he's not chayav any monetary damage that he does along the way. Vinir daf, the guy who's being chased, shishiber tekelim shirul dev patur. If he damages the property of the guy that's chasing him, he is patur. Shleyem amono chaviv alav migufo. Because it can't be that his money is worth more than his life. This Rodef has basically been mafkir his life, because anybody who sees him can kill him. So if he's giving up his life, then certainly we can't say that he has to be responsible for monetary damages done to the Rodef's property. That doesn't make any sense. Aval shokol adam chayav. On the other hand, the nerdaf who damages someone else's property, he is chayav. He is responsible to repay it. Dasur latzil atzmo b'mamon chavero. You do not have a right to save yourself with someone else's property. If you do save your life with someone else's property, then you're going to be responsible to pay for it. So again, if it's under duress, if it's a case where your life's in danger, you're right, it's not an issue of yehare val yavor, so he's allowed to protect himself. But with that will come a necessity to compensate your friend for the fact that you took his property to defend yourself, or you damaged his property in an attempt to save your life. Virodef, sherodef, achara rodef. So now we have someone who's chasing. B is chasing A in order to kill A. B is a rodef. C comes along and chases B to stop him from killing A. So C is a rodef achara rodef. So in that case, rodef she rodef achara rodef latzil v'shiber kelim, and he breaks kelim. Ben shel nirdaf, ben shel kol adam patur. Whether it's the guy who is being chased down, A, who is the victim over here, whether it's third party's property, in all those cases he will be considered to be patur. Velo minadin. That is not by the letter of the law. By the letter of the law, it should be chayav for any damage that he does over here. Ela she'ima i'ata umerkin. If you do not provide this indemnification, ein lecha adam shematzil chavero min arodef. Nobody's going to intercede on behalf of their friend. If interceding on behalf of their friend is going to cause them monetary loss or significant monetary expenditures, then nobody's going to intercede to save the life of their friend, because then they're going to be chayav. Basically, this is the equivalent of a good Samaritan law. If someone does the right thing and intercedes on behalf of this person to save their life, if in that process they cause damage, we're not going to hold them responsible for that damage, because they're acting properly. This is what we want them to do. This is the moral thing to do. And therefore, to encourage that behavior, we give them an indemnification. And now the next Mishnah begins. Shatfa Nahar. If the river comes along and washed away the field that this person had stolen, Omer lo areshul chalifanecha. You can say to him, here's your field. It's flooded now. It's full of water now. This is your field. It's your bad mazel, but here's your field. Take it back. You don't have to replace it. Tarabanan. Hagozel sadeh mechavero. Person who steals a field from his friend. Veshat fanar. And then it's overrun by a river. Chayav lamid lo sadeh acher. Divi Rabbi Elazar. Belazar believes you have to replace it. You have to compensate him for the stolen land. Chamim omrim, omer lo arishol chal lefanecha. The chamim say no, you can just hand him back the property. Say, here's your property. It looks a little different. Your problem, this is the property back. And obviously the chachamim are the authors of our mission over here. By Maika Miflagay. What is the machlok here between Rabbi Elazar and the Chachamim with regards to whether he can say Arish Lechalif and Echor or not? The answer is, Rabbi Elazar Darish Ribuye Umiyute. Rabbi Elazar uses the methodology of the school of thought of Ribuye Miyut in being darshaning the psukim in the Torah. Whereas the Chachamim, darshan beklal uprat, and again we've discussed this in the past, the basic idea is that when it comes to a klal uprat, we see the pratim being very connected to the klal. They are qualifying the klal, klal is speaking about those particular pratim. On that end, in the methodology of ribuy and miut, everything is considered to be separate, meaning that a ribuy is an inclusionary statement, a miut is an exclusionary statement, but it's not that one is qualifying the other. And therefore, you'll end up with much more expansive inclusions by ribuy and miut than you'll have by klal uprat, and we'll see evidence of that in this case as well. That the ribuy is bikichesh ba'amito, that he denies owing money under oath to his friend, that's a ribuy. Bipikadon, and then it lists the items there. There you go, pikadon, sumet yad, all different items that he denies. Those are miyutim. Then it ends with kol ashei shava alav the sheker. Anything that he takes a false oath about, he will be responsible then to pay a keren v'chomesh and bring an asham gzelot. Chazav riba. Riba umiyetu riba. You have a riboy, an inclusionary term, a miyut, an exclusionary term, and then a riba. Riba kol. In the methodology of riba miyut riba, that tells you that you include everything. Umay rabbi, rabbi kol mile. We include everything. My miyet. What does it exclude? Because you have one miyut. So what we'd say is that the miyut demands that you exclude one item from here. What's that one item? Miyet shtarot. That we exclude is shtarot, because shtarot don't have inherent value to them. So that's the only item that's not subject to the shvua of denial over here of monetary obligations. And therefore you're not going to be chayav, keren chomesh and a korban for a shtarot. Now even over here we're not speaking about shvua, we're speaking about whether you can steal the property and hand it back. These laws that apply here apply by other dinim with regards to gzela and geneva, and the same is true in all these cases. It's a question of whether karka is included or not included. According to Rabbi Elazar, it is included. Rabbanan dashi klal uprate. The Rabbanan, on the other hand, used the methodology of the school of thought of klal uprat, which is v'kichesh klal v'pikadon prat o mikol asher yishava alav the sheker is chazar v'klal klal uprat uchlal. And you know from Rabbi Yishmael that means when you have a klal uprat uchlal, that means that the prat gives you something that's a common denominator from which then you take the klal and include anything that looks similar to the item that is the prat. Ma prat davar mitaltel v'gufo mamon. Just like the items that are enumerated in the pasuk, in the pratim, have the following characteristics. They are movable items and they have inherent value. Avko davar mitaltel v'gufo mamon. So too, gezela and taking a shvua and asham zelot will only apply to items that are immovable and that have inherent value. Yatsu karkaot, that excludes property, she'en mitaltelin. Real property doesn't move. That's why it's real estate. It's the item that is permanently in that position and therefore it's not subject to these laws. Yatsu avadim shukshu the karkaot. Avadim are excluded because they have a hekesh to karka, meaning that an eved kanani is deemed to be like possession or property. Yatsu shtarot, shavu pishu mitaltelin, ain gufo mamon. And shtarot are excluded because even though they are movable property, they don't have inherent value. They just give you a documentation of an obligation or a documentation that will obligate. But they themselves have no inherent value. They're just a piece of paper with ink on it. So that's the explanation of machlok between Rav Elazar and the Chachamim, basically whether you can be gozel karka. Can you steal land? Is land subject to the rules of gzela, to shvua, and denying the owing of money, is it also included in that? The Blazer believes, yes, it is, because of he darshan's ribuy umiyut. Chachamim say, no, it's not, because they darshan klal uprat. That's the explanation here. Gemara challenges that and says, we have a brayta, gozela taparav shatfanar. He steals a cow, and then they washed away by the river that overflowed. Chayav lamido para. He has to replace it. Divrei Rabbi Elazar. Chamim Ramim. Hare Omer lo Asher Chalafanech. He goes, go get it. It's down in the river. You can go get your par. You can go get your cow wherever it is. But here you see that the machloket persists even when we're not dealing with real estate, even when we're not dealing with real property. Here, this has nothing to do with karka, shtarot, anything like that, yet they still have a machloket. So that can't be the explanation of their machloket. It says, what are they arguing about over there? And Rapapa, Tama Maiskinan, Kishgon, Shigozel, Sadech Havero, Vaita Pararu Vutzabo. He stole his friend's field, and there was a cow crouched on the field. Vishat Fanar, and then it was overrun by the river. To Rabbi Lazar the Tamei, for Rabbanan the Tamayu, Rabbi Lazar's the Shitato, and the Rabbanan the Shitatam. Can you steal the karka? Rabbi Lazar says, yes, you can steal the karka. Well, if you can steal the karka, then you also get the cow with it, because it's a kinyan agav. If you can make a kinyan on the karka, and you acquire the karka, agav the karka, you also get the metalkalin that sit on the karka, that's the cow. On the other hand, for the chachamim who say you can't steal the karka, then you never have a kinyan on the karka. If you don't have a kinyan on the karka, you also don't have a kinyan on the para, because you never made any separate kinyan on the cow. Therefore, the resultant halacha is that if the cow gets washed away with the river, if you think that you are responsible to replace the field, that means you're also responsible to replace the cow. Because if you're responsible to replace the field, it's because you made a kinyan on the field and you stole it. And therefore you're responsible for it. And when you stole it, you also acquired the cow on a kinyan agav, and you're responsible for that as well. On the other hand, for the chachamim, we say you can't steal the property. You're not responsible to replace the property when it's overflowed, the river overflowed onto it, and you can say, Arshel Chalef Anecha, because it always remained in the possession of the original owners, and you're just handing it back to them. So too, the cow. You never took possession of the cow, because you never took possession of the land to take possession of the cow on a kinyan agav. So you don't have possession of the cow. You can say, Arishal Chalafanecha, I never took your cow. I have no responsibility for your cow. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Yud Chet, Amud Aleph.